Cinema Jaws brought to you by The Nattercast. The Nattercast is a television podcast covering premium TV dramas including Game of Thrones, True Detective, Mad Men, Better Call Saul, and more. Their podcasts feature lively, informative conversations with a great deal of humor. In addition to the podcast, Nattercast has a thriving Facebook community where listeners discuss a wide variety of TV shows, as well as movies, games, and web series. Check out what they have to say and listen to an episode at www.nattercast.com. And by Everrath. Are you looking for a way to escape your boring life? Searching for an exciting new fantasy book series? Fantasy author Joseph Macalino is here to help you. Check out Amazon.com to find his latest books in the Everrath series, and that's E-V-O-R-A-T-H, and begin your own epic adventure in Everrath. Anything is possible. Podcast ever. This week, in honor of Pac-Man's 35th anniversary, we are putting together some of our greatest video game movie content from the past 5 years. You're going to hear an interview with Stephen Ogg, who plays the voice of Trevor on Grand Theft Auto 5, as well as Tron himself, Mr. Bruce Boxleitner. And not to be outdone, Mr. Adam Fendelman from Hollywood Chicago will be talking the top 5 greatest video game movies with us as well. So eat some mushrooms and power up, jawheads. Tuck in for a thrill ride of epic proportions as we present our top video game content of the past 5 years. Happy birthday, Pac-Man.
All right, you're listening to Cinema Jaw. We're here at C2E2 with Bruce Boxleitner and the guys from Lantern City. So before we get started, guys, why don't you each say your name and what you do for the project?
Bruce Boxleitner, co-creator, executive producer.
I'm Trevor Crafts. I'm also the co-creator and executive producer.
Matthew Daly, writer.
Now, the interesting thing about Lantern City is this idea, Matt was commenting about this as well, that you are actually reaching out to the fans to get ideas for artwork. Storylines as well, or just the artwork?
Right now, just artwork. So basically what we've done is we've created a workers forum where steampunk makers and artists can essentially submit their own prop designs, costume designs. Steampunk is such a wonderful community of makers. They're so adept at building things and creating artwork that really rivals Hollywood prop houses. And so we wanted to make sure that the fans were engaged because nobody's really been able to crack the steampunk code, as it were, in media. We really haven't seen anything that was great true steampunk television or film. They've dabbled a bit here and there, but engaging the fan base first, showing them that their work was going to be highlighted. Basically, you submit online and you have a chance to have your work featured on the show on a prop. So maybe that somebody designs a wonderful pair of earrings, and then in one of the episodes, Martha Ellen Gray, who's played by Mira Furlan, will be wearing them in an episode. So just like little prop extras that just helps with our imagination and the whole collective imagination of all the fans.
Yes, I think in creating Lantern City, I think the detail, those tiny details like those earrings are very important. All of the steampunk. I don't know that a Hollywood prop house would go to such detail and imagination as some of the things that we've seen. Yeah. It's incredible, and there's no limit to it, you know. So I think this is a really good way to go.
And take us to the roots of Lantern City. Who came up with the idea and how did it get started?
I had the idea a couple of years ago for sort of a much more pared-down story, but just the idea of somebody traveling to a different place in this sort of fanciful and amazing epic steampunk world. And Bruce and I had worked on a pilot together. I was executive producing a pilot called Smokewood, Nevada, which was about it's a comedy western, which is sort of like Tombstone meets The Office.
Nice.
Bruce was playing Johnny Morgan, the old cattle bear.
Yes, I was.
Yes, you were. And I was looking for a partner. I was looking for somebody that wasn't just a Hollywood person, but somebody that really understood what it would take to build a huge world. Bruce, obviously, through Frontier Earth and his other novels, he's a great writer. He's got the experience and the understanding, like, you know, saying earlier about just having the understanding from Babylon 5 and things like that. And then we brought Matt on. Matt and I had worked together. Matt and I won an Emmy together for a documentary that we produced in 2009. And it was the right pairing. It was the right team. And Matt really took what Bruce and I had in our heads and just exploded.
Put it on paper. It was amazing.
And it was like somebody. I still feel a little weird about it. I'm not so fresh.
You should.
It's still in my head. It's weird.
Well, and I think that, you know, what they've both said to me, especially after I really got working, even just on all of the outlines and all these things, is that, like, we saw this as a big scale, but you've made it a lot bigger than we even thought, which they were good with because it was, you know, a very rich world and stuff like that. But,
I think very doable production-wise. Doable without being tremendous. Well, everything's expensive today, okay, but it's the degree of expense. And I think this we have the technologies today that are can do this.
Yeah.
You know, say that in the 90s when we did Babylon 5, the effects shots and things like that, which was a combination certainly of practical sets, built sets, and early CGI, you know, and television was still very new to that, and which I think they did a marvelous job. But more importantly, I think this show is about an ensemble, you know, compelling characters the audience, we hope, will become intrigued by, fall in love with, be abhorred by, whatever, and want to follow every week, just like we have with Game of Thrones and Boardwalk Empire and so on and so forth.
And the premise of Lantern City is this idea that there's this alternate Earth that the characters actually travel to through a lantern. Mm-hmm. Can they travel back from that alternate Earth, or once they've traveled there, are they stuck there?
It's the nice thing. What we've done is that nobody knows. It's not like the Stargate where you go through on one side and you see the telephone on the other side, and if you know the code, you go back. I think that's really what sort of enhances the drama, and what Matt certainly has put down on paper is this idea that there's no way home. You don't know if you're ever going to get back. And so when Rachel, who's one of the three main characters from our world, is transported to Lantern City through this lantern, she doesn't know if she's ever getting home. And so what do you do if you don't know if you're ever getting home? How do you change your personality? And Max tries to find her and sees her in this lantern image and falls through the lantern image as well to go and see her for just another minute. I mean, that's really, I think, also at its core, it's really about how far would you be willing to go to be with that person that you love more than anything for just one more minute, just one more second to be able to see her again. And it's about that drive to find people that really, I think, is in the, that's what's in the middle of this whole huge story.
And I don't think any of the characters know how they even got there. No one has put it together that it was that thing that, you know, initially.
Right, like
but the mystery of this show will be also, what is it that got him there through this marvelously ornate slide projector? You know, wood and brass and big lenses lantern. And things like that. This magic lantern, which they were called at that time. But they don't really understand how they got there or how they're going to get back.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say
that. I think that gives the storylines.
If you want to quote, like, put it in quotes, like the science behind it, we don't necessarily explore because we're really interested in how are these characters involved in this world. And our three main characters from our present day world, they all are forced to change. Just to survive, they cannot be the same people they were. And so it's one of the things we explore too is who are they really? Are they the people in Lantern City? Is that who they really are? Who are they people? Because we see them a little bit from before. And that's just, you know, one of the great things that fans will be able to grab onto, you know, like, oh, is she really that way? And, you know. So.
And I think we learned in the Star Wars universe, George Lucas sort of ruined the Force when he started talking about midichlorians, and he got too scientific about it.
Yeah, once you try to explain the magic, it's gone.
Exactly. Oh, I love episode one.
Actually, you really?
Well, I guess this interview's over.
No, I think what's important is that the magic.
Right.
Actually, that
suspending your imagination and your belief and going with it. I want the audience to go with it. You know, and forget about trying to explain it.
Another thing, too, that I did, I mean, because we are, you know, fanboys as well, is I built the world that we will never see on the show. So if we were going to have our episodes 1 through 3, we've built that before we got to our show because it needs to be authentic. Right? You don't want to like, oh, well, we're going to do this prequel series now. What the hell would that we do? I don't know. Well, yeah, let's explain the lantern, I guess. And yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But we don't want to run out of, we're not going to run out of steam. That's the nice part.
We've
got it. We've got, oh!
I see what you did there. Very good. Woo! Actually, that brings me to one of my questions. It's easy to take for granted here at C2E2 that everyone knows what we're talking about, but maybe some of our listeners don't know. What is steampunk?
I think that's left to interpretation. It's our version of it is going to be Lantern City. But, that word, I knew what it was when I saw it. I've saw it at conventions years ago when I first started going to these conventions. And being a history lover, I think all three of us are, that's a fascinating period. But I knew it when I saw it, but I didn't know what to call it. And I want audiences in near future to say, what is steampunk? Oh, that's that show Lantern City.
But, I mean, I think for the a lot of people categorize it as like a Victorian futurism. It's the idea that if steam technology and clockwork technology was taken to some impossible level, that our modern computers could be built out of steam and things like that. I think that's really the crux of it. But there's a lot of political intrigue about in most steampunk stories, which definitely is very true in ours as well. You've got the Grey Empire, the workers, this growing underground. There's all these political classes that are constantly in flux and pushing and pulling, and but which is very much that Victorian ideal. Steampunk is this growing social movement almost in fashion. Prada has now steampunk lines of clothes.
Yeah, definitely an art movement.
Yeah, very much so. IBM just predicted that the next year is going to be the year of steampunk through their algorithms about how many posts there are online and, these kinds of things. I know there's a bunch of steampunk reality shows that are in development right now. So it's definitely the time is sort of coming into their own. And it's an interesting group of people because they don't have any media. Steampunk fans have no Star Wars to latch on to. They have no, Oblivion movie series. There's nothing. There's nothing that's really that they really love, and that's one of the things that we've set out to do is to be the first show that really wears the badge proudly of steampunk.
Right, and I think it's important for us because we definitely want our steampunk fans, and I know they're hungry for it, but we also need a wider audience. So, like my elevator pitch for the show is like it's The Wire in a futuristic Victorian setting. Because you have all these different strata that are, competing and intertwined and all that stuff. Bruce said, people say that is steampunk, but it's a lot bigger than that, too.
Yes, of course it is, yeah. It's left up to interpretation.
So for the Jawheads listening to this, we call our fans the Jawheads, and they want to get involved with Lantern City. Where's the best place to find more information online?
The best place to go is lanterncitytv.com, which is our main website, and also gives us links to the Facebook page and the Twitter page as well off of lanterncitytv.com, and that's really the most important thing right now. That's what networks care about is viewers and fans and that pre-built fan base, and that's if you really want to help Lantern City, follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook. Those are the numbers that really count.
And awesome. Bruce, obviously we're a movie podcast. We got to talk to you a little bit about Tron, as we do top five lists every week, and Tron pops up numerous times on different lists.
Isn't that amazing? It still amazes me after 30 years. It's crazy.
And I wanted to ask, too, the idea that Tron back in the day was such a game changer as far as the effects, and so was Tron Legacy when it came out as far as the 3D. Mm-hmm. What was it like making the first Tron with all technology?
Like what we were talking about at Lantern City, you didn't know you were doing that at the time. We were doing something that could have been an abysmal failure. Everyone knew it. Steven Lisberger, who had brought this idea out from, he was from Boston. This was, I give Disney tremendous credit because they are willing to, a first-time director, Joe Kaczynski, by the way, too, with Tron Legacy. And this new idea, and is it going to work? It almost didn't. There was so many things that happened. I think people also think that Tron was CGI, and it was put in the CGI toaster and popped up, and it was all colorful. It was actually a blend of old school sitting down and hundreds of people in Taiwan hand-painting every cell. 62,000 each cell had to be done.
My head hurts thinking about that.
Yeah, it was beyond belief. And it was about 20 minutes, actually, of this CG at that time it was called. And now, and the strange story is that Tron was exempt from the 1982 Oscars in animation because we were accused of cheating. We used a computer.
Wow. How times have changed.
How times have changed. So it's a marvelous phenomenon that keeps living on. I'm just so happy and proud to be a part of it. And I know the third one is in the works. That's all I know. I have no other things to tell you, but I think that says a lot, you know.
And you're also voice Tron on the animated series
the
for
animated
Disney?
The animated series as well, yeah. So I've done all things Tron. I'm the Kingdom Hearts game, the Tron 2.0. I've kind of kept at it, and for some reason I just realized this horse is going to keep running for a while, and I want to be with it.
Thank you guys
awesome.
So much.
Yeah,
and
in this next segment, we talked to Adam Fendelman of Hollywood Chicago. One quick note, we recorded this a while ago when we were still in a different room in the back of Mother's, and you can hear a lot of music. The show's come a long way since then, but we thought that the content here was really good, so we wanted to play it for you in honor of Pac-Man's 35th. Here we go with our top five video game movies of all time.
All right, so here we are, top five favorite video game movies. Adam picked this topic. He's a gamer at heart. I'll start us off with my number five, and it's a very, very weak number five, but I was very determined to have one movie completely based on a video game on my list, and I myself think they're all terrible, so I can't wait to hear what Adam has on his list. But number five actually might be the only one that I saw. I went out and rented it because I loved the video game. Came out just last year, starred Jake Gyllenhaal. It was not a very good movie. I'm talking about The Prince of Persia.
There's a lot of bad video game movies, but this one is not a good one at all.
No, this one isn't good, but at least it had the production value and tried to be a huge summer blockbuster movie, but I ultimately thought...
Tried, all right.
Jake Gyllenhaal was the wrong choice completely. It would have worked a lot better with a sort of a no-name actor.
Yeah, first of all, Jake in that film, he was too damn pretty.
He was.
Like, even when he got dirty, he was pretty. And, like, he just was not gritty enough. And, one of the biggest issues with that one is it takes itself too seriously. I think video game movies are typically bad. Mm-hmm. And I think they're bad because they take themselves too seriously. I think the ones that do it well are almost the B movies. You know, the ones that are funny, that are mocking, it's hard. Like, most people are not geeks.
Right.
And so if you get people who like the video game, you know, they're going to come to the movie. But for everyone else, they're just going to make fun of it.
I agree.
You know, so you have to, like, take the majority of your audience who probably doesn't know or like that game, and you got to make it work for them. How do you do that? You make it funny. Or you don't take yourself too seriously.
Good points. And I thought The Prince of Persia did. That's why it sits at number five. Number five. Forgive me. We're going to swing it over to Adam's number five.
I'll think about it. I'll think about it.
We'll swing it over to Adam's number five. We'll see what he's got sitting there.
Well, I didn't actually order mine. I just came up with basically, if I tried to find five that were actually not sucky, here are these.
Okay.
So
throw one at us.
Yeah, one of my first was Silent Hill, and most people don't remember or know this. This is Sean Bean. You know, this was 2006. They made this film fun. They made it over the top, and it's a B movie, and it's not trying to not be. And it's been mostly forgotten since then, and it's now coming back in 2012. Unfortunately, they're going 3D.
Which, oh boy!
Yeah, I'm over that.
Big shock there.
Silent Hill Revelation 3D again with Sean Bean. This one again has Roda Mitchell. They're adding Malcolm McDowell in this one. But
really? Jeez, that guy's hard up for a job.
Yeah, well, you know, he's got to take a gaming movie because he's got so much experience doing that. Yes. But this one stands out to me because it was saying, I'm a B-movie and I'm okay with that. And it was fun because of that.
Nice pick at number five. Matt, what do you got?
All right. I'm just going to get this out of the way right away, okay?
Uh-oh.
At number five, everybody thought of this immediately when they heard the topic, Resident Evil. I was huge fan of the video game. I really like the casting. Mila Jovovich is amazing in this movie. You know what? Yeah, it's based on a video game, but this turned out to be a genuinely scary zombie movie, which I'm also a big fan of zombies. So all around, great. Amazing special effects. I'm in. I'm in. Resident Evil, my number five.
All right, nice pick there. We go into our number fours. And at number four, I have a movie that's not necessarily based on a video game, but is about a video game. Came out in 1984, one of my family's favorites growing up, The Last Starfighter.
Maybe on my list later.
Oh, wonderful. The kid lives in a trailer park, Matt. The only thing he's good at is a video game called The Last Starfighter. But it's not just a video game. It's actually a training outpost to find good starfighters. And so Alien comes down to get Alex and bring him up to defend against the Armada.
Yeah.
Fantastic movie if you haven't seen it. I don't think it lives up to today's standards if you had not seen the movie prior to. But for the jawheads out there that are interested, give The Last Starfighter a spin. It's sitting at my number four.
I'll talk more about it when we get to mine.
Beautiful. What do you got, Adam?
For number four, you brought up Resident Evil. I was gonna slow play that one, but you brought it out.
See, yeah, I came out blazing. Sorry, man.
You know, she's Jason Bourne with boobs and
beautiful boobs.
So now we gotta, on that topic, we just gotta throw in Tomb Raider. Angelina's
nicely
got
done.
Huge adventures.
She's had at least two of them.
I played these games. I was a Tomb Raider as a kid, and no, they're not. It's not good acting, and no, it's not even necessarily good storytelling. But you know, I do like Jason Bourne kind of adventure, you know, Indiana Jones kind of adventuring movies, and
sure,
and that's who Lara Croft is, and they're not the best films in the world, but they're fun, and I want to do that and look like her. So
strong pick at number four. I figured Tomb Raider was going to be popping up. Matt, what do you got at number four?
All right, I have the 1989 Fred Savage vehicle, and I'm just going to say Power Glove and Super Mario Brothers 3, The Wizard.
You just talked about this one. I forget what the other thing was, like traveling movie. Somehow it came up.
I don't
again.
Know. Yeah, I try to bring this movie up as often as possible because it was one of my favorites as a kid. I mean, this really glamorized and popularized Nintendo for an entire generation of movie-going children. And it wound up being a two-hour commercial for the Power Glove, sure. But it was a lot of fun getting to that commercial, and I really enjoyed Fred Savage's performance. And the girl, Jenny Lewis, who's in this, who I said on the last time I brought this up, she didn't turn out to be good-looking. Turns out I was wrong. It's just her IMDb picture is kind of funky. She turned out okay, and she puts in a great performance in this movie. Sort of a pinball wizard story, but I really enjoyed The Wizard. So,
strong pick. I figured it was going to be on your list, Matt.
I couldn't resist.
No buzzer for you yet this week. Goes into our number threes. Another one, obviously not based on a video game, but the video game of this movie actually, I think, brought about the sequel. I'm speaking of the 1982 Jeff Bridges film, Tron.
You're like one step ahead of me, dude. Actually, wait, what is this? Your number?
My number three.
It's my number three as well.
Ah, beautiful, beautiful.
So you're talking Tron, not Tron Legacy.
Right, not Tron Legacy.
Okay. The original.
It was interesting how Tron sort of spawned this awesome video game, Tron, which kept it so relevant, you know? Like, I mean, I think that the film was merited its own sort of
cult yeah.
gathering behind Tron, but I think the video game itself really propelled it. I remember playing the video game and liking it more than I ever liked the original movie, and then it just sort of stayed in the forefront of everybody's mind until Tron Legacy just came out last year.
You know, not to get too into video games, but the coolest thing about the Tron video game is it really was one of the first games that introduced mini games, because it wasn't just one thing that you progress through. You had the light cycles, you had the tanks, you had the deadly discs that you threw around,
right.
And all the games that he played within the movie where you had to fight the CPU at the end. So that's what made that video game cool. And plus that controller, it was unique.
It
you
was,
know?
Yep.
Yeah, this is a great movie, and it spawned an amazing video game, and you're right, that's what kept it relevant.
Yeah. So that was my number three. What do you got sitting there, Adam?
All right, I got to bring up not the 1900 movies after this first one, but the very first Mortal Kombat, 1995. That was Paul W.S. Anderson, who also did Resident Evil.
Mm-hmm.
That first one, not because the special effects were good, because they weren't, or the acting was good because it wasn't.
They weren't good?
No.
No?
But it was 1995. I mean, you got what you got then. But the fighting, the sequences and the which to me, I mean, who didn't play Mortal Kombat?
Right, at you least know? A little bit. You
and
know?
And like to me that was fun to be mm-hmm. Sub-Zero and to be you know and to be able to like do that kind of stuff. So
get over here.
Exactly. I mean, who didn't like Flawless Victory? So yeah, I mean that was the right time. It was an original breakthrough game, and that movie.
Great one.
I like the pick. Yeah,
I mean, yeah,
the only flaw I had with the Mortal Kombat movie was I really wanted to see him like rip hearts out of chests and do some fatalities. But other than that, I agree. It was fun.
That's all about rating then. You know, do you want rated R?
I do want rated R.
Well, yeah, but then the kids aren't going to be able to see
then
it.
Then they don't make
the
as much money.
Okay, all right. The kids didn't see it anyway.
So what'd you have sitting at number three? You had Tron, Matt?
Yes.
Beautiful. So it swings us into our number twos.
We're doing well.
All right. My number two came out in 1983, and it stars Ferris Bueller, Matthew Broderick, Ally Sheedy. I'm talking War Games.
This came up in the suggestions on Facebook. It's a good pick, Rye.
David, played by Matthew Broderick, is a whiz at the computer that still had the green screen, and he accidentally taps into the mega computer, the Whopper, I believe it's called. And he thinks he's playing a game, but he's actually setting off World War III between the Russians and the Americans. It's fantastic. Comes down to a game of chess. Another family favorite.
Tic-tac-toe.
You're right. Sorry. Tic-tac-toe. I just love how he was so savvy with the computer. Back then, that was like when the personal computer was just coming out. I was like, whoa, this guy can just hack into these systems. It was
before the word hacking even
existed.
Yeah,
it was so cool.
Yeah.
I love it. I love War Games. That's my number two pick.
Yeah, it's can't argue with that, man. Great pick.
Yeah. What do you got, Adam?
All right, so I'm going to say this one because this is from the guy who did House of the Dead, Blood Rain, and Alone in the Dark. All bad movies, but Postal. I don't know if you remember or know this one. This was Uwe Boll. So he's known as one of the most controversial directors in Hollywood. He does some of the worst filmmaking in Hollywood, and he hardly ever makes money. Postal was 2006, based on the video game, and I remember when we wrote our review of this, our headline was Uwe Boll pukes out another opus of insufferable screen time in Postal. And the thing that I do like about it, even though it's a terrible movie, he offends everyone equally. And that's cool. Like, he's racist to everyone. So it's not like you're going to go see that movie and say, that's racist. Well, everyone and everything about it is offensive.
It's anti-human is what you're saying.
Yeah, so I mean, on one hand, it's not hard to be offensive, and so I'm not saying anything about him is talented, but it's still amusing. And
sure.
Films are about drama, making an emotional connection, or being entertaining. And this is entertaining.
It's a guilty pleasure?
A guilty pleasure, yeah. Like, you'll hate it, but it's Howard Stern. You hate him, but you kind of like him.
Hey, I like the guy.
Rye loves him.
Well,
all right. So that's Adam's number two. Matt, what do you got?
I had The Last Starfighter, man. And
there you go.
Yeah, for all the same reasons you mentioned. I mean, this again was part of my childhood. I remember fantasizing about playing the video game and going up to defeat. I used to have that whole thing memorized. Greetings, Starfighter. You're yep. blah blah blah. Kurg and the I don't remember. Anyway, it was a fantastic romp. The graphics were good for the day. I mean, you know, well, actually, that kind of sucked.
Yeah.
But that's what made it fun.
It was a family film, though. It was a lot of fun.
A lot of fun.
Yeah. So it swings us into our big moment, our number ones here. Mine, I think, is going to be the same as Matt's because we talked about our love for this film. I'd be shocked if it's not sitting at your number one. It's a documentary.
Yeah.
Came out in 2007. Let's say it together, Matt. King of Kong.
King of Kong, yeah.
Fistful of Dollars.
Quarters, yeah. I said dollars, but it's quarters.
Steve Wiebe, in this movie, has lost his job and decides to try to break the Donkey Kong world record. What? What record? It's actually held by Billy Mitchell. This guy is hilarious in the film. I mean, he held this record for something like 20, 25 years. It's a documentary that just has such well-placed humor. the story's fantastic. You actually care about the people in the documentary, but you're laughing along the whole time. It's a rare feat to pull off such a fantastic film like this.
I actually think if you look at all the films we're talking about, and you know, we're saying a lot of bad things about a lot of these films, this is one that didn't do it that way. A documentary is probably a better way to do a video game movie, and I think that's why that one is so successful. You're not doing what Prince of Persia tried to be a blockbuster movie.
Right.
King of Kong wasn't. It was a small budget movie, and it's just a bunch of dudes who play video games, and I think that's what made it work. It made it real. It didn't try to make it blockbuster.
Yeah, because I even loved the aspect of when they would talk about the science of Donkey Kong, how there were two barrels, the double jumps. Even that was entertaining.
I have the same. I wasn't a Donkey Kong guy. I'm a Ms. Pac-Man guy.
Uh-huh.
I have one in my living room. The original stand-up game.
Nice.
Yeah, made here, and I'm revealing my. My gamer, I guess. Made here in 1980 in Midway Games, and I literally went to the guy who made the games, and I designed my own mazes for it. So I have custom-designed mazes from Ms. So I'm...
You are a nerd.
Yeah. But, like, I could tell you... I mean, there are things that, like, I shouldn't know about Ms. Pac-Man. Like, this was just like a... It's
the
not,
man who knew too much
yeah, like,
about
this
Ms. Pac-Man.
Like, do you know, like, this was, like, one of the initial forms of artificial intelligence? Like, those ghosts, which are all colored, have algorithmic mathematical destinations.
Yeah.
And they have patterns. The red one will always kill you the most. I mean, like, there's no memory in this game, so it can't even remember its score. But, like, it was smart enough then to, like, have patterns. And you know, it's... So, there's my speech on that.
Yeah, plus we're running long here. What do you got at your number one?
All right, so for my number one, this one isn't... I'm cheating a little bit. Because it's not based on a video game, but it's a video game movie. And this was more recent. And I just had a fun time with this one. Scott Pilgrim. I mean, you know, this one, like Michael Cera. I think the reason this video game movie works is because it appeals to the gamer and anyone. And even if you're not a gamer, it's fun. It reminded me of like the old Batman, like wham pow, like it's not trying to be serious, like,
right?
It's fun.
It's and fun. I
self-referential,
agree.
Yeah,
and it's geeky, and it's okay with that, and like I don't know, like I had fun with that movie.
I did too. It was a fun movie. I thought it was a little redundant trying to get through all the boyfriends, but I still gave it a strong recommend here on the Cinema Jump.
Well, that was the film's attempt to have a story,
right?
You know, I would have been fine if they just played games.
Yeah.
But they had to, you know, unfortunately have a story.
Those damn stories always get in the way.
And so, Matt, you also at number one have King of Kong.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah.
So there are number one video games, Scott Pilgrim and King of Kong. Check those out, jawheads at home. If you haven't, put down the video game controller and rent these movies. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we got DVD reviews, trivia, and a segment we call...
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
The Blue Collar Commemoration plays rock and roll music. You can find us on the e-sites of iTunes, MediaNet, Rhapsody, Nokia, Amazon, Google, Deezer, Aspiro, Vervet, Omniphone, RDIO, and Cricket Communications. Seek us out today.
Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
And we are back on Cinema Jaw. In this last segment, we give you an interview with Grand Theft Auto's Trevor, Mr. Steven Ogg, one of the most surreal experiences of my life. We'll see you next week, Jawheads, with a fresh episode. Hope you enjoy this interview with Steven Ogg.
Boy, oh boy.
Oh, yeah.
Here we go. Oh. We got Trevor from GTA coming on.
I'm actually a little nervous here.
I mean, you want to talk about a psychopath.
Well, Trevor is the psycho of all psychos.
Yeah. Without further ado, we bring in our guest, Steven Ogg. He is an actor. He voices Trevor from GTA. Steven Ogg, welcome to Cinema Jaw.
Thank you, sir. Delighted to be here.
You know, it's pretty funny, Stephen, in our emails, you were so polite to me, and in the back of my mind, all I could picture was Trevor, and I'm like, Trevor is being so nice to me. It was really surreal.
Actually, when I get, because the Trevor thing, I get sometimes in an elevator, let's say, when I'll be talking to someone, and, you know, I consider myself a fairly cordial fellow, but if I'm talking to someone I know, and occasionally I'll, you know, maybe be in a bad mood or something will have happened, and if I have to use an expletive as I'm talking, and also, this has happened numerous times now, I'll be in an elevator, and I'll be talking, and all of a sudden, you know, this fucking guy, when I was coming here, I just wanted to fuck, and I get angry, and someone inevitably, in the elevator, there's sort of, I feel the eyes turn to me, and people behind me, but I feel this sort of, this stare, and I look, and generally it's been a male. And as the elevator door opens, sort of sheepishly, are you Steven? And they usually call me by my name, which is nice. Are you Steven? Are you the guy who played Trevor? I'm like, yeah. Was it the cursing? He's like, yeah, I recognize the cursing.
You know, that's interesting. I was actually going to ask you, like, how often do you get called out on being Trevor on the street? Like, do people recognize you? Because a lot of people probably don't know that that the likeness of Trevor is based on your likeness.
Yeah, well, that was always something that we sort of had. You know, it was interesting because I know L.A. Noire was marketed with the actors in mind because they were name actors and they were sort of known and they wanted that to be known. Whereas for us, we always knew it would be our likeness, which was part of my appeal of doing the project, script and character aside, was that, hey, wow, I get to be an animated character, essentially, based on my likeness. It's interesting that I find it's like if I were to say, oh, I don't normally get recognized tomorrow, I will be recognized. It's always when I say I don't get recognized, I end up getting recognized. And it comes and goes in waves, actually, with people. Like I said, generally, if I'm in a confined space somewhere in an elevator and I'm cursing or saying something or sort of growling, that's when people tend to recognize me more so than walking down the street. Although in my neighborhood at the Upper West Side of Manhattan, my son has got street cred from older kids in the school, the grade seveners, and they have recognized me and, hey, Steven, and they always say hi to Bodie. Hey, Bodie. And he kind of looks at me like, okay.
Well, you're big with that crowd.
Such a jackass.
That's awesome, man.
Now, I got to know, too, Steven, did you play the Grand Theft Auto games before you got cast as Trevor?
I didn't play any games before. I have not played games since, and I probably won't play games after. I've never been a gamer. You know, I'd sort of said the story when I first did this game, and the director, Rod, you know, said, do you know about these games? I said, no, absolutely not. Have you ever played them? No. So we went into the back room, and I think it was Red Dead or Red Dog Redemption, the Western game.
Yeah, great game.
I was blown away. I mean, I was, everything about it, I was like, wow, and horses, and this is really cool. And so I had the controller, and I don't even think I could get on a horse, and I spent about 10 minutes with it, and Rod kind of shook his head and patted me on the back lovingly and said, you know, I'll just stick to the acting.
Well, we're glad you did, man, because the performance that you turned in as Trevor is definitely one of the, if not the best, greatest video game performances of all time. It's probably the closest thing that you can get to actually playing a movie. At least that was my experience. But I want to take it all the way back to the beginning and tell us how you got started in acting and, you know, what got you on this path to getting the role?
Well, I was born a poor black child. I started in Canada growing up doing theater in Calgary in my hometown. That was just something I got into when I was 11 or 12 years old and loved doing theater and acting. And it was funny and ironically enough that it took doing this video game to almost come full circle into why I loved acting, why I got into acting. Doing this process for 3 years with the game really rejuvenated and rejuiced my passion and love for acting. It's about the play. It's to play. It's to have fun. That's why I started doing it. And there were some times where I got, you know, you get a little disillusioned a lot of times in the business.
Sure.
And this role and this experience more than the role, because it's always these experiences that one remembers, the people you meet and work with. And it was just such a fun, great time that it was like, yeah, this is what I was doing. It reminded me of when I was 13 and I was in this British play called The Long and the Short and the Tall, and I was playing a British soldier, and I had to try to do my British accent and learn how to use a bayonet and pretend to stab someone on the stage and not spill my cup of tea. And that's kind of what Trevor was like play. And when you're doing motion capture, it's even more so. I mean, it's such a technical thing when you're covered in these balls and you have your entire environment animated on the screen, but in the studio you're shooting in, you know, that Trevor's trailer is simply Cape and the amazing people that worked with Rockstar that created out of bars and apple boxes and everything they had. They would create the actual dimensions or the chair or where the TV was, so you had something to interact with, but it was pure play and pure imagination, just like when you were a kid.
That's awesome. Like, okay. And how long did the process take to make Grand Theft Auto? I mean, is it months that you're recording and doing all this stuff?
It was 3 years.
Wow.
No, yeah, he mentioned
that. That's crazy.
Yeah, it was pretty fucking wild. I mean, I had thought it was a year. That was the initial idea, as though we're doing this for a year. We didn't, of course, do the whole time. It was seasonal work,
mm-hmm.
You know, sort of the winter, spring, summer, and fall. There would be kind of a three-week period where we would generally go in and do motion capture for 10 days. So maybe, you know, 10 days, four times a year, 40 days over the 3 years. And then it was really not until the very end of the third year where we were going in and doing strictly voiceover in a booth, and that was generally all the things in the car, the dialogue, the stuff where you're not needing to perform, aside from the voiceover.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a very minimal part compared to the process of the actual performance. When people sort of would say, call it a voiceover performance, I didn't take umbrage with it, but I was like, I wasn't performing in my underwear in a booth, acting off nothing. It was, you know, me and amazing actors that they had assembled. And, I mean, some of these day players, I mean, Jonathan Walker, who plays Devin Weston, Rob Bowe, plays Steve. I mean, these guys are amazing actors and theater actors. I mean, Jonathan, I just saw again on Broadway. He was in Assembled Parties with Judith Light on Broadway for a big run. It was pretty incredible to see the people that would come in to the thing, and even old vets of the stage would come in, and, you know, these sometimes septuagenarians wearing the spandex and balls, and they were just like, what is this? But you talk to them, and, you know, they're like, the stories. And even the lady who played my mother, she acted with Laurence Olivier in England. She did the first sort of classic live theater, sort of masterpiece theater, when it was actual live theater recorded for the BBC.
That's awesome.
She worked with Olivier. I mean, she was just like, Jesus, let's sit down and just talk about all this
stuff. That's,
so it was
that's
amazing.
Funny. Whenever I'm trashing an actor, I always say, he's no Laurence Olivier, you know? That's like my go-to line. That's that's fantastic. I don't know if you had any inkling before. I mean, you said you're not a gamer yourself, but obviously you probably had heard of Grand Theft Auto. Nobody could have predicted the tremendous success that it had, but I mean, it was the fastest selling entertainment product of all time. It went to $1 billion in like 78 hours, something like that. Did you know, I guess before you took the project or when it was offered to you, did you know like, hey, this is one to take? And I guess the second part to that question is, has it opened some doors for you?
I didn't know there were other actors that were much more in the know throughout the process, through the release of it, that were like, do you know what this is? Like, I was constantly reminded. And I was like, no, I mean, it's a car or video game thing, right? And I'd see the posters and, okay, what's it about again? Like, what is the game? And I was really kind of oblivious to it. And it's not like I chose to ignore it, but I was like, I mean, there's nothing I can do about it anyways. I mean, my job is to go in and do the best work I can every day. And it doesn't matter if it's a short film or a huge video game or an audition. It's, you just try to put your best effort in, because that's what you go home with at the end of the day, right? Like, hey, I did the best I could today. So none of that certainly affected me, or I never thought of it, and I never... It's amazing. I mean, it's cool to be a part of it, but I've often said it sort of doesn't change the way I take a piss in the morning, you know?
It's, yeah.
There's nothing I can do about it. It's cool. It's exciting. It's nice to be a part of that, and to sort of, you know, to have these posters and these images and to have your face on all over the world.
Sure.
And I still get daily emails through my website and through people finding me. That's the most touching and surprising and amazing part to me, that, you know, I just got one today from, you know, Winnipeg, Canada, which is my father's hometown, and, you know, whatever. And then, but then there's, like, I get ones from Thailand and Japan, a lot of British people, huge UK, Scotland, Ireland, Germany, Turkey. I've been having requests to, like, do interviews with this, you know, Turkish online thing. That to me has been the biggest, not the most overwhelming, but the most impactful repercussions of it. To be like, shit, this is a global thing, and I don't know how I could possibly use that or whatever, aside from if I am in a film that goes somewhere, it could certainly, you know, I sort of have this built-in audience now where there are people that, you know, there's this fan club called the Oglers.
Nice.
And they're women.
No, so you got some groupies, huh?
Yeah, which is surprising, because at times I don't know if it's coming based on seeing me, my website, and my work, or it's because these people somehow are attracted to Trevor, which concerns me.
Yeah.
So... you know, and I'm not out there talking to these people, and I try to, you know, maintain a presence with them, and I appreciate and thank their support, definitely. But it's pretty interesting.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that is so
really
great.
Awesome.
And you mentioned that your father's hometown was Winnipeg. Did you ever see the movie by chance, the documentary called My Winnipeg?
Yes, with that was, what's his name? The director.
Yeah, I forget his name too. Throw it in the jaw box. Our engineer will look it up during the break. What a great movie, though, huh?
Yeah, and actually, I auditioned the other day for the filmmaker Ruta Nada. She did a movie called Cairo Time with Patricia Clarkson.
Oh, I love that movie. Sure.
Yeah, beautiful. And also, did you see Inescapable? That was her latest one.
I have not.
That's amazing. That's an amazing film too. So I just yesterday put myself on tape for that. And honestly, like, those are the projects that I'm kind of the artsy fartsy dude. I love that. I mean, listen, I wouldn't turn down a network show or anything, mm-hmm. but if I could just be working on the smaller films, if you want, that just have such heart and soul, it really feeds my artistic soul. Like, it was great. And she's a great Canadian filmmaker that I adore. So.
Yeah, well, we talk movies here every week on Cinema Jaw, and I'm right with you, Stephen. It's those smaller art house movies that I love and adore so much that really bring the passion.
Yeah, and Stephen, no, that's not my opinion at all. I'm into the wham bam thank you ma'am action films, and but you know,
and that's where it's interesting, because that's where you're just wrong.
I see where this episode is going.
Trevor is on my side. Yeah. He's gonna beat your ass, Matt.
Yeah, I get angry very quick.